So we decided to do is to do a mixed talk in the sense that I'm going to start giving the introduction, and then I'm going to pass the talk to Jorge, who's going to show you the first part, the first technical part, if you wish, which is present some models. So it's Jorge who's going to discuss this part, say more or less 20 minutes, hopefully. And then I'll go back to the Blackboard, and I'll tell you about results that one can derive from these models, and that hopefully can be applied into the world of granular matter. So originally, these models have been proposed as simple, solvable, and more or less understandable models for glassy systems. Not granular matter. But, well, as Jorge will probably mention, they can be modified in slight ways to accomplish, say, try to describe also granular matter. But the main thing we want to tell you about is the results that come out of these models without proofs, because it would take certainly much too long to do it, but at least to show you the main, one of the most relevant results that can be derived analyzing the static properties of these systems and the dynamic of these systems. So for statics, what I mean is that we are going to say something about the number, structure, and properties of metastable states. And for the dynamics, the points I'm going to stress is the development of a separation of timescales. The development of a violation of the fluctuation dissipation theorem. You heard something about this already this week, how this can be used to define an effective temperature, and why, what I'm going to try to stress is why, if one is careful and takes into account the separation of timescales that appears in the glassy regime or dense granular matter situation, so if one is careful and takes into account the separation of timescales within the definition of this effective temperature, one can actually go on and prove that this definition has the good properties of a temperature. So it's not just a definition, but it behaves as what one expects a temperature to do. So what I'm going to say is mainly a couple of words about this part, and how this may apply or not to granular matter. And so this could be the third part, the checks that have been done to verify that what was proven analytically for the models have also appears in more realistic systems with short-range interactions and things like this. So these checks are mainly numerical, and there are also some experimental checks. And I'll relate briefly how this effective temperature is related to these metastable states through an entropy or a complexity. In the field of glasses, this quantity that counts the number of metastable states is called a complexity. Or configurational entropy. While in the field of granular matter, it could be the equivalent of Edwards entropy. Okay. So finally, I'll just mention now, but I won't say anything about this, that these ideas have been applied in other fields too, just to mention them. So rheology, quantum systems, spin, Fermi. So other kind of systems which are out of equilibrium, and where these ideas of an effective temperature may also seem to play a role and appear. So I won't say anything about this. So just one more more thing to remark before giving the talk to Jorge, is that about this complexity, the relation with the effective temperature and so on, and I'm sure, well, you heard already from this about this from David Ginn, but I guess that not all of you were here when he gave the talk. I presume that maybe Javier also gave a talk on this, and in any case, he made a lot of works on this field. And next week, there's a talk by, if it translated correctly, Matthias Schwetter, who's going to talk about experiments on this idea. No. Oh, let me give you a video.
Okay, so I've been outsourced, or I am the outsource for the first part. I just want to try to argue in favor of a series of models that gave a scenario. I'm sure that I will have a tougher job here than in a purely physics context, so I'm going to try to be convincing if I can. So, first of all, let me say a quick remark about mean field in general. So when you have a ferromagnetic system, as you know, the easiest you can do is study a model where all spins interact with one another. So you do something like this, all pairs. And as you know, this is solvable, and you can do it. It's an exercise one does with students. It's unrealistic, of course, but once you solve this and you find that there is a kind of free energy landscape at high temperature that becomes like this at the critical temperature and does this in the low temperature phase, and so you have a magnetization. When you solve this, you feel that you understood something about how the spins self-organized to do this. Of course, it would be much better to do a phenomenological description of what every spin does in a real material in finite dimensions. And I suppose that when Mr. Curie or whoever did this, he was probably very criticized. But I think that one feels that when you solve this problem, you understood something. There's something universal you learned. I'm saying this because usually mean field theories are very criticized, but one has to take into account that the mean field aspect here, by the way, is the fact that we say that everything interacts with everything else. Now, it's perfectly justified to criticize this from the point of view that things do not interact in this way, but let me say that normally one criticizes mean field because one has been already within mean field and has moved on, and not because one has not understood what mean field had to say, which is, I think, the first step. So the general idea is to do something similar here, to try to see how, without perhaps a good description, but just to see how things self-organize to give a glass. In a theory where we don't put what we want to get, we pose the rules of the game, and then we see whether the system does it on its own. We're not doing phenomenology. So let me say that the something that is related, or the analogous thing to do if I want to do interacting particles, is well. Let me. Oh my God. Okay, so let me say the analogous thing to do would be, well, I want particles such that all interact with all, just like with the spins. Why this? Because this will make the problem solvable. So one way of doing this is, imagine I have a sphere in n dimensions, n is going to be large. You know, for spheres to be able to have many neighbors, because we want them to interact all with all, we need high dimensions. So let me suppose that I have a big sphere, which is going to be my space, and on top of it I have, say, n minus 1 dimensional sectors, which are the particles. I have m of those. And if I, so the coordinates, I'm going to call them SA. This is a coordinate SA. And the potential is going to be some function of SA minus SB, let's say, of the distances. Make it repulsive. It could be hard spheres. And the coordinate, I have to say, is an n-dimensional vector. So, so for example, V could simply be a hard repulsion. So this seems, of course, a high place to. Can I erase your planning? This might seem a very high price to pay, and it is, of course, just like asking spins to interact all with all was a hard price to pay. But we do this because we feel that we can solve this problem much better and without making any further assumptions. So we made already quite a heavy one, and that's all that we're going to do. So what happens with such a model? Suppose I am going to imagine that it's not hard spheres, that it's some sort of repulsive soft potential. I'm going to do that just because I personally prefer to work with temperature, but it could be the same and working with some form of volume. So what happens is that, imagine I simulate this problem, but I could also solve this. I start from very high temperature. What I find is that at high temperature, the energy goes down as the temperature goes down. What I get is what I can identify as a liquid phase. What I see is that the particles rattle they move very fast or easily. And the thing, this goes down. And this goes like this until at a certain temperature, which is sharp, at a certain temperature, something happens and the system blocks. The energy blocks almost completely. It should even be perhaps even more horizontal. And several things happen at the same time. The first thing is that, well, I see a discontinuity here, a discontinuity in the derivative. I see that the energy blocks. I also notice that the dynamics of the system becomes extremely sluggish, and I also note that I fall off equilibrium.
What are the rules for this evolution, and what are the...
Could be, for example, just to fix ideas, a Langevin dynamics, or it could be a Monte Carlo, it doesn't change anything, and you very slowly change your temperature, which in Monte Carlo is what it is, or in Langevin, and you just go down, or it could be molecular dynamics. Doesn't change.
If you have in mind a Gibbs state that's being
there. Well, so what happens is the following. I cool very slowly, and I can show that I am reproducing the Gibbs state at each point. The moment I get here, nothing, if n is large, I find that I cannot equilibrate anymore. And this happens in a sharp way. Dynamics becomes very sluggish. Indeed, if I do the simulation very, very slowly, maybe I can equilibrate a little bit further, but then it will fall off. This is at a slower speed. And yet another slower speed will do this. And what happens is if I do it for very, 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 very slowly, I will get to some ideal thing. But here, very slowly in this model means that it depends upon n. So when n is very, very large, there is no way I can equilibrate. So how much I can penetrate or how much I can continue to thermalize depends on n. This is a feature that is we don't have in real life. If I could do a simulation really slowly, what I would find is that not only I have that, but there is a state which is very ordered and which depends on n in a very strange way, which is what we would call something like a crystal, which exists, but to which it is extremely difficult to fall. It is very much below this situation, and I can only, for very, very small systems, manage to get there. So this is what you would normally call the glass transition. It is, unlike the real glass transition of real life, this one is sharp. It is sharp for large M, and this is a pathology of mean field. Real glass transitions in real life are not sharp. They are sort of smeared out. They are not real transitions. This, for large N, is going to happen at a single temperature, and that's that. So this is, but notice that the model has done two or three things. This is what we would call normally the liquid phase, where it's easy. This is an out of equilibrium situation, of which Leticia is going to describe in detail. And of course, how do we know that it is out of equilibrium? One of the ways we know it's out of equilibrium is that a slower thing goes elsewhere, so it cannot be in equilibrium. But that's not a nice thing, way to put it. A nicer way to put it, Leticia is going to tell you about. But you can study this regime, shouldn't even call it phase. And you can study also this state, which I call crystal, because it depends on the, it is a particular order, and in every problem it is a different thing. And in this kind of problem, it depends on number theory, typically. It has to do with how you can pack spheres. This is a problem that people who do error correcting codes, for example, are interested in packing spheres this way, and you get solutions that have to do with number theory and depend on each problem. But this is what I'm going to call crystalline state.
One question, when you say liquid, you mean like fluid? You don't
yes.
think surface tension is an issue?
No, I mean a fluid, yes. Yes, I mean a fluid. I could.
You just mean that the spins are just fluctuating.
Yeah, they fluctuate. It's easy to equilibrate. Yeah, I could add something to have a. After all, there is no essential difference between liquid and gas. No, I mean. Okay, but these are not they are and they are not spins for the moment. So, this model is a bit hard to solve. There is a simpler version. By the way, I'm not following the historic path at all. I'm following a. But you could make a rather simpler model that, believe me, has exactly the same phenomenology. Instead of using this kind of variables on the sphere, to use spins like this, but with Si plus minus 1. And for example, a model that is simpler is so, but these, the spins are plus minus one, so the vectors now live on the edges, on the vertices of a hypercube. Because this is a scalar product, you pay in energy if you, I mean, you want to be orthogonal, and so particles, it's a bit like that model, but now the particles are living here, in the edges. Now I cannot do Langevin because it's a discrete model. I have to do Monte Carlo. Believe me, you get the same thing. And the crystalline state is, in this case, the minimum of this. So you realize you have to create orthogonal vectors made of plus and minus ones, because here the elements are plus and minus one. And this is an old problem in number theory. So, okay. But you get the same phenomenology. So it is, what I'm going to try to do now is a chain of models which have the same phenomenology and become simpler and simpler, but also become less and less obviously related to a system of particles. So this vaguely looks like a system of particles in a mean fieldy way. This looks a bit less. Now I'm going to do one that looks even less. Now this looks really, now this doesn't even attempt to have particles. This is just a spin model. And what is strange about this spin model is that the interaction term, this is an orthogonal matrix, by the way, you recognize the Fourier transform matrix. This matrix, it's like I and J go from 1 to N. So you see, it's a bit like a pseudo-random number generator, because you have big numbers in here and you're taking the sign. So it's a bit, it's not disorder, it doesn't have any quench disorder, but it's a very like this pseudo-disordered system. This is a spin model. Of course, now if there you didn't see very much particles, here you don't see them at all. The only justification to consider such a model, which is even simpler, is that it has, again, exactly the same phenomenology. So, and this one looks easier to study. So I'm doing the theoretical thing of trying to reduce things to the bare minimum so that I can do more things with them. Now I'm going to do a big step, which is...
What way do you study this one? This one looks as if it might be analytically solvable.
This one is analytically solvable, yes.
Can you do the sort of cooling rates with this thing?
You can study the dynamics of this, and the actual practical way to do it, you'll see it in a second. In fact, you show that for large n, it is the same thing to study the dynamics of this problem as studying the dynamics of a slightly different problem, which is the following. This model looks like this one, but instead of using this matrix, which is, you see, an orthogonal matrix, you use a random orthogonal.
And there's no sense of dimension here.
No. It's everybody is connected to everybody else. The sense of particles is lost. The only justification for this is that I am still keeping the original phenomenology. So I can check that with a computer and then attempt to do the actual analytic solution in the simplest of all. So that's the justification.
By dynamics, you mean Glauber dynamics?
For example, yes. Yes, here it could be Glauber. But if you do Monte Carlo, it doesn't change dramatically things.
In Monte Carlo?
You just adjust your temperature. You do 100 steps with a temperature, 100 steps with a different, 100 steps with a different. Oh, this is just standard. So here I did a big transition. So I'm stretching and stretching your faith. Your confidence. This model and this model, the one that has this specific form of interaction, which is non-random, and the one where this is an orthogonal matrix, where I choose a generic orthogonal matrix chosen at random, you can prove that for large n, I'm not giving the names of people who did it each step because it would take some time, but if you want, I can tell you. For this, it gives the same solution, and it's easier to solve, because now you can average over the ensemble of orthogonal matrices, and it becomes easier to solve. But notice that another conceptual transition is that I introduced quench randomness, which of course doesn't exist in real glasses, but the only excuse I have to do so is that you can prove that the dynamics and a part of the statics is the same. The only thing that I lost in doing this transition, this you have to take my word for it, it has to be proven, is that the crystal state, the ordered state, disappears. It is no longer there. So you get exactly the same phenomenology, but no crystal state. This is what you lose when you go to the random. And apart from that, nothing else. And because this crystal state is irrelevant as far as the glass is concerned, you don't fall there, it doesn't change much.
Model an infinitely slow quenching, you never cross the crystal.
Oh, you do. If you go really, really slowly, yes. And then if you go with that kind of protocol, you would realize that you're not doing so here. Yeah, sure. But let me say that this model, for example, which where I was involved, if you do N50 already, there's no way you can get very deep. It really gets very slow. Well, okay, so let me just do one more step, which is also quite typical in StatMech, It's often easier to study spins that are not plus minus one, and this is an old thing in statistical mechanics. For example, considering a spherical model, often without justification, but only that it gives you things that are non-trivial and technically simpler. So it turns out that there is still another, even easier system, for example, where you have spins, a single spherical spin, and you have this. This is a three-spin interaction, and these J's are Gaussian random. So, if you didn't believe very much on the relevance for particles at the first one, here it's completely lost to you. But now I have a lot of things to say about this one. This one, the only justification is that in this chain of models, the phenomenology is preserved. It's the same. That's the first justification. It works the same. I don't have any crystal because it's a random model. But
it's a three spins.
It needs at least three. Not two. Two won't do. It needs three or more. Then, second justification is that it turns out that here you really can do everything. This model has been beaten to death from every single point of view. I think I will leave to Leticia talk about. But whatever you get for this one turns out to be true of all this chain of models. That's an important thing. But beating this one to death is easier than beating the first one to death. This one has been completely beaten to death, and it has a critical temperature. Above the critical temperature, the dynamics is exactly what is called the mode coupling theory. This is an old theory that for glasses has a certain number of people who like it, and it is even experimental people, and it is the exact dynamics of this model are the mode coupling theory equations. And these have been known for a while. They are interesting. They have a certain number of properties that are interesting. And for the temperature below the critical temperature, then you have the effects that Leticia is going to describe, aging, effective temperatures, etc. And this is, and a third justification for this model in its last version is that instead of introducing things the way I did, there is another way I could have done it. I could have started with a real particle system, write a lot of diagrams, a diagrammatic expansion, tell you that I want a subset of those diagrams because I'm going to add those because I like them, and the addition of the subset of diagrams gives you the mode coupling theory, which is what you get by just starting from this model. So let me say that there are two ways of justifying this end product of the chain. Either as a chain of models that get progressively simpler and more abstract, or by saying that I can get the same equations by doing just some approximation on a realistic case. So I get either I treat exactly an approximate model, or I treat approximately a real model. So both approaches you will find in the literature. So I think that this is all I want to say.
Can you clarify again the reason for the three spins?
Yeah.
These SIs are not plus minus one. These just are the sum of SI, of all the SIs is
spherical.
Yeah. So if it's
trivial answer for
something? Yeah, not trivial, but not quite what you want. It's the two-spin problem on a spherical thing. You know, the potential is like a rugby ball, no? It's an ellipsoid. And it does have interesting properties, but it is like an ellipsoid. So in fact, the absolute minima are going to be only two because you have all the directions. And instead, if I plot a polar, let's say, plot of what this potential looks like, it has many, 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 many valleys. So this is the reason why three or more are necessary.
That's exactly the same
as
Einstein polarization.
The two spin, yes. which is a real pity, because if this one you can beat to death, the two spin you can do more, I don't know, you can beat beyond death.
Okay, so I have to say a couple of words about results that can be derived, but as you said, without derivations. So the first thing is about static properties. So what can one do? So what can do the statistical mechanics, say, compute the partition function of that model at a certain temperature, and observe that there is a static transition. Jorge didn't talk about this, but okay, if you do naively the analysis of this partition function using replica theory and so on, you will get that there is a static transition at a finite temperature, TS, where the behavior of the system changes. But I'm not going to talk about this one. I'm going to talk a little bit about another approach, which is more relevant for the discussion that comes after, which is to try to write a sort of effective free energy. So first of all, identify a good order parameter. Just like in the fully connected easing model that Jorge discussed at the beginning as a motivation. So you know that if you want to study this problem, which is just the fully connected ferromagnetic easing model, you can write down an energy density, which is a function of the magnetization density, 1 over n, sum over I is I, and that this free energy density has the form that Jorge mentioned briefly. At high temperature, it has only one minimum at m equals 0. At the critical temperature, it becomes flat, and at low temperatures, it has a double well form with two minima. So you realize that at low temperatures, there has been, so at TC, there has been a transition to a low temperature phase where the system prefers to go to a magnetized state with the value m star that depends on temperature that you can also compute. Now, for these sort of problems with disorder and glassy properties, of course, this magnetized total magnetization density is not the good order parameter. It's a trivial thing. You have to find out which are the good order parameters. And it's not too difficult to realize that what you have to do is to try to write down free energy density, which depends on local magnetizations, which are just the average of the spin SI, thermal average of each spin. So now I cannot do a drawing like this one, because of course my horizontal axis is not just one dimensional one. It's not just one variable. There are n of them, n order parameters if you wish. So I cannot do a drawing like this one. But I can derive, one can derive analytically this function, f omega I, and try to look at its saddle points, just as here one looks for the minima to identify the states, and also one can identify the maximum semi-stable state. So doing this calculation, what one finds is that actually there are a lot of minima and a lot of saddle points of all sorts, and typically people draw a picture like this one, sort of a ragged landscape, what people call a ragged landscape. What is it? Okay. So, it's not a rug? Anyway, I don't know what you say. Okay, so here in the, on the plane, what you have to imagine is that there are many, many directions which I cannot write. And here on the vertical, what I'm writing is this f of mi. So what one can try to do is count. Count the number of minima, count the number of maxima, count the number of each type of saddle point, you will have saddle points of all sorts, in the sense that since there are many, many directions, you will have many directions in which this one, for instance, has a well-confined potential on the other direction, etc. So what you can do is define this sort of complexity, meaning that, for instance, I can define a complexity as that is a function of the F I'm going to look at. So I'm going to cut this landscape, say, at this height, and go and count how many minima I have, like this, for instance, how many minima I have which have this value of F. And then take the logarithm. So this is the number of saddle points of order k, which fall on this slice of value f of this free energy density. Take the logarithm and define it this way, a complexity that depends on the order of the saddle point I'm looking at. So say that k equals 0 corresponds to the minimum. Then I compute the number of minima that fall here. Here I can see the maximum and so on. But remember that this plot is easily defined on the blackboard because there are so many directions on that I should write, but I cannot. Okay? It's going to be related. One can do the relation. But for the moment, let me just define it this way. I am defining it this way because I want to first of all say that, okay, this corresponds to the minima one can identify later on with sort of block configurations and so on and so forth, related to Edward's ideas, and then go on and related to temperatures, so effective temperatures. So, but what the thing I want to say is that these quantities can be computed exactly for these models, and then you can go on. It's not too difficult. The techniques exist in any case. So this is the part of the aesthetics I wanted to mention. Now, what about the dynamics? And how to relate these ideas to dynamics? So as Jorge said, the good thing about working with continuous spins is that it makes the model simpler, but it also gives us the possibility to work with Langevin dynamics, which is easier to deal with than Glauber that you mentioned before. So one can write Langevin equations for the evolution of each of these variables, go on, solve the problems, look at the relevant macroscopic observables that will tell us about the dynamics of the system. So the first thing that one recognizes... Can
you write at least one so we can have an idea?
The equation, you mean? Yeah, oh, yeah. So, yes. So, S dot, you have here a friction constant, if you wish, that normally one absorbs in the time scale. So, okay, this is why I didn't start by writing the gamma here. Then you'd write the variation of that H, which is here, with respect to Si. And then you include a Lagrange multiplier. That will enforce the spherical constraint. So this is a function of time. Let me put the time dependence everywhere. This set here is a function of time that you fix after solving the problem in such a way that it enforces this spherical constraint to be valid at all times. Actually, it enforces it. We just enforce it on the mean. This mean means an average over thermal noises. So this is a thermal noise, which is given by a Gaussian distribution with zero mean. And delta correlated in time. Okay, so temperature enters through this term here, you can set it to zero in the sense that in these models one can take the T going to zero limit and this doesn't hurt. I mean, all what I'm going to say remains valid. I'll tell you which is the temperature dependence of the results in a second. But there is no special problem about setting T to zero in the calculations. This is friction. Okay. And this is kind of the deterministic force. Which is like a graded descent. So.
And now you're going to deal with this numerically.
No, this we can, with this one we can deal analytically, yes. Only that, okay, I won't tell you exactly how we do it. We can discuss it later on if you wish, but it would take long to do it.
One clue, I mean, you really can do it accurately?
Oh, yeah. You can. The technique is you use a generating functional method, you know, to put this in a generating functional like Martin C.J. Rose. And then you identify which are the global relevant quantities that you have to define of other parameters that you have to define. And these are the two that I'm going to discuss next, which is the global correlation. And the global integrated response function. Let's define this. So this is a global correlation function. This is a linear response.
And the little h is just a linear term you're adding.
The little h is a small field that you apply and you set to zero to compute the linear contribution to the response function. And it turns out that if you write this dynamic generating functional, well, this is not precise in terms, but basically what happens is that you can write it as a path integral. Okay, I'm being a bit sloppy here, but what the main thing is that you can write this dynamic generating functional as a path integral over C and R, defined in this way, the fluctuating values actually, and then you can pull out an n here due to the mean field character of the model, and you can evaluate this by saddle points. These saddle points gives you equations for C and R, which are horrible. They are integral differential equations, but you can solve them. And these C and R equations are the ones that look like the mode coupling equations for the liquid at high temperatures, but are different from the standard mode coupling equations, but they are still mode coupling equations, but I mean they are different from the ones that appeared in the literature in the 80s, in the sense that you cannot get rid of the response. You have to take these two coupled equations together and solve them together. You cannot, you know, just simply replace the response by the correlation using the FDT, because the FDT doesn't hold. So what you have to do is to solve for C and R and check what this gives. And okay, what this gives is what I'm going to tell you next.
In the usual case, the mode coupling theory would come out of a lower order loop expansion.
Right. This is what.
In the case that if you do the loop expansion, then all the higher.
Yeah. For these models, it's exact. So what happens is that you have two ingredients. You have this long range interaction in the sense that each spin interacts with all the other ones. So there are factors of 1 over n that will help you killing or taking to zero certain terms, which vanish in the larger limit. And the other feature is that there is disorder. So these interactions are random, as Jorge said. And then, to be precise, what I'm talking about here is an average over thermal noise, but also average over this disorder. Okay, average over the distribution of these J's. And when you average over the J's, you kill the other terms. So I mean, all the terms are killed, either because of n goes to infinity or because the J's are
random. The three-spin thing is just doing the mode coupling.
It is doing the mode coupling, yes. Yeah, exactly. So it was realized in the 80s that it did the mode coupling in the high T phase, exactly. Below TC, okay, it's one has to be careful about the solution. When you know, these equations are exact, the equations for these two quantities are exact, then you have to solve them. Okay, you have to keep the two equations, this is what I mean. Okay, so let me go back here. So what I'm going to say is, what is this C doing first? So first important thing to mention is that what I'm going to tell you is about the behavior below this C, because it's a part where this, say, this C is this PC that Jorge wrote here, so it's this off-equilibrium regime that I want to discuss. So if one goes and solves these equations analytically, what one observes is that actually this solution does not depend on, let me call it G, not to confuse you. It does not depend on a difference between the two times, as one usually encounters in real, I mean, what is used to find behaviors which are stationary. It happens to be that below TC, this is not true. These correlations depend on the two times involved in their definition. So what I mean by this is that if I draw here an axis of time, this is my initial time where I, say, quench my system. I take my temperature and I put it down to some value here. Or if I do this annealing, this slow cooling that Jorge was mentioning, is the time where I reach a working temperature I'm interested in. I realize that if I look at the relaxation after reaching this initial condition at time zero, and I measure the correlation of the configuration of the system between two times, T prime and T after zero, and let me take T larger than T prime for convenience, then I realize that if I plot, say, in logarithmic scale, the log of the correlation against the log of the time difference, I get one curve for one value of T prime, but I get a different curve for another value of T prime, and yet another curve for another value of T prime, and so on. So there is a dependence on this T prime that I'm choosing as the first time in the evaluation of my correlation, that it doesn't disappear. It stays there forever, below TC. So this is below this TC here. So this effect is what is called aging. And it has been observed in simulations, experiments, and so on in glassy systems. Basically, what you have to remember is that there is a time scale for the relaxation of the correlations, a tau, usually it's called tau alpha, that below TC depends on T prime. It's not only a function of temperature and, you know, other parameters that you may have in the definition of the problem, but it also depends on this T prime here. Okay? And the longer the T prime that you use, the slower the relaxation, so the longer the T alpha. Okay? So T alpha is a growing function of T prime. So this is the aging phenomenon. But the other thing I want to stress about this curve that I draw, or these curves that I draw, is that you see that I draw a plateau here. I mean, I put that, I draw the curve for the longer T prime, this one here, as a curve that approaches a plateau, and then it departs from this plateau, and that actually is the departure from the plateau, the one that is explicitly dependent on T prime. So there is a plateau, I'm going to call it QEA. And the correlations, what they do is that they approach the plateau and they stay on the plateau for very long, for long T primes, and then, okay, eventually they go down. Okay. So this is the behavior that one observes from the solution for the correlation. Notice that the approach to the plateau, I tried to draw it in the same way for all the curves. So what I mean here is that I don't see the T prime dependence above the plateau. When the correlations take values which are above the plateau, I do see it below. Mm-hmm. Now, I can do another drawing, which is to compare these curves for the correlations with curves for the response that I also get from the analytic solution.
Have you actually defined T prime in this now?
I'm sorry?
Have you actually defined the T prime? It's presumably it's some sort of
No, no, there is no definition. It's just one time that I choose to compute my correlation. So this is the time.
Sure.
You see, this is the origin of time. So the initial time where I prepare my system and then I let it evolve. Here is where I choose my initial condition.
So now you're preparing. Preparing it in some
equilibrium? No, 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 random initial conditions. Because what I, any initial conditions which is not equilibrium. Because what I want to mimic is this.
It's not the same as at infinite temperature or something like that.
It could be infinite temperature. At an infinite temperature, initial configuration is random, typically. So I can choose that one and let it evolve.
Prepare it initially random conditions.
Right.
Let it evolve at a particular temperature.
Yeah, any temperature below TC. And then I compute.
And then you compute.
Right. But the important point is that actually any initial condition which is not correlated with equilibrium will do the same. Okay. So it's any typical initial condition. So just to stress, T prime is sometime here and T is sometime there.
How does it depend on the parameters that you chose in your equation?
Well, this one I can absorb. This one, actually, I can absorb in the time scale here, because actually I should have written it here, but I have already absorbed it in the delta. And then the value of TC depends on the strength of these interactions. But apart from that, there is no big change. That the behavior is qualitatively the same for any, as long as I am below TC, right? Yeah, this is like a macroscopic time scale that I have eaten up. Okay. So what I want to do is to compare this correlation to the response. And what is actually easier to do, instead of working, to plot, not to do the calculation, I can do it for R, but to plot, is better to plot an integrated response function, which corresponds to integrating this equation over a T prime, this second, let me call it, to make it clear, that goes between T prime and T. So the thing I'm doing is that if the linear response corresponds to applying a kick at T prime only, so this H is applied only at T prime, by integrating it, I've integrated a linear response, so it's as applying a step of field of the strength H during the interval that goes from T prime to T. Okay. So this is easier to represent what I'm going to do next. So if I call chi of T and T prime this integral here, and I do a similar plot, I realize that the shorter waiting time does something like this. So notice that I'm integrating a positive quantity. So the more I integrate, the more chi should increase. So I'm fixing T prime. I'm integrating over a longer interval. So chi increases as a function of T minus T prime. So the first T prime, the white one, does something like this. But now if I plot the next one, the one that I plotted with orange, that I don't find, he will do something like this. And then the next one will do something like that, and so on. So I also see the waiting time dependence at the level of the response. And I also see that there is a plateau, so there is a separation of time scales. Below this plateau, let me call it chi EA, I don't see a waiting time dependence. I do see it afterwards. And I also see this feature that the shorter the waiting time, the faster the increase of the response in this case. As here, the shorter the waiting time, the faster the decrease. So I can also identify this tau alpha of T prime from the evaluation of the response. So, okay, the things to remember about these plots is that there is a separation of time scale. under its agent. Now the next thing I can do naturally is to compare the response and the correlation. I know that in an equilibrium situation, these two are related by a very simple equation, which is model independent, and which is the fluctuation dissipation theorem, that simply tells me that chi of t and t prime, actually of t minus t prime in equilibrium, because in equilibrium stationarity holds, but let me write it in full generality. The statement of the FDT says that the integrated response is in linear relation with the correlation function through a parameter here, which is 1 over k, or 1 over t, I'm setting kb equals 1 to simplify. And notice that here I made all the correlations start, well, this is a logarithmic scale, but start from 1. For these models, the correlations are normalized. You can also normalize them in more general cases. So what this equilibrium FDT tells me is that if I do a plot of, say, this curve against this curve, I should find a straight line with slope 1 over t. So what do I mean? I mean that I'm going to put in the x-axis c, in the y-axis chi, I'm going to fix t prime to be the first one, fix t prime to be t prime 1. And I'm going to do a parametric plot using t the longer time as the parameter. So let me do this construction. At t equals t prime, the correlation is normalized to 1, so I should start from here. If I put t equals to t prime, the correlation is equal to 1. In equilibrium, I have this relation, so here I have 0, 1 minus 1, 0. So chi should be 0. So I should start from here. I'm doing the equilibrium construction, right? If I let t evolve, the correlation should decay, so I should move in this direction on the x-axis, while the integrated response should increase, so I should move in that direction in the y-axis. And this relation tells me that something like this should happen, a straight line relation with a slope minus 1 over t. Okay? So this is the expectation in equilibrium. Now, if I do this construction for those results over there, what I find is something different. What I find is that I put chi, I put c, I start from 1 and 0 here, and let me do it for the first t prime, t prime equals 1. I will see first here a straight line with the good slope, the slope of equilibrium given by the external temperature. But then there is a breaking point just at this value QEA and at this value chi-EA, where the slope changes. And we still find another straight line, but with a slope which is different, has a different value. Now, if I repeat this construction for the longer t prime 2, I find the same curve. And OK, if I do it for longer t primes, still. So what this means is that this construction approaches a stable limit in the long t prime limit. That this limit is non-trivial. It departs from the equilibrium result, which would continue like this. The fact that it departs is not surprising, because I knew already that the system was out of equilibrium because of this aging property. But what is sort of surprising or encouraging is the fact that what happens next is rather simple. It's another straight line with a different slope. So, okay. So one is tempted, of course, to say, well, if this slope here is the slope is given, dictated by the external temperature, let me call this new slope here a temperature. But are we entitled to do that? Is this, is that a definition, or is there is more to it? So Well, it's sort of late, so I'm not sure I got.
Is this a numerical result, or do you?
No, this is analytical. You write down, as I said, from this expression, you can write down exact equations for these C and R.
So
you can solve them.
If you didn't look at the integrated response,
right.
The derivative of the integrated
response, yeah.
On some time scale, you would have this proportionality of the time of response function to the
derivative.
Function. The coefficient would change discontinuously.
Yeah. So what you have to, this is why I said it's much nicer to do it this way. This same statement I'm doing here is equivalent to say that this ratio changes from 1 over t to 1 over t star.
Yeah, so in the analytic expression, you see some discontinuity.
Yeah, you can see it. Yes.
It's like it's continuity, it takes time, only that compared to the total time, it's very short. It's not really
extended. So in the actual t prime going to infinity limit, when you do it in the calculation, you know, to t prime to infinity, then you will see a discontinuity. But if you do it softer, so t prime is very long but not strictly infinity, you will see a crossover. Okay? But the fact is that here, the crossover, we are compressing it into a point. You see, the crossover seen in the correlation is this full length of time difference where you are around the plateau. But in this parametric form, we are just compressing it to a point, so it's much nicer to see it this way. This is one of the reasons to present it this way. Another reason is that if you people who do simulations, there have been an enormous number of simulations on realistic systems like Linear Jones and, you know, so many other ones. And in those cases, it's much easier to apply a field or a perturbation during a length of time than do it instantaneously. Instantaneously, it's a mess because it's very noisy. So in practice, it's easier to start to implement the integrated version than the other one.
Do we see the same phenomenon that you see, or
yes.
Is it idiosyncratic?
No. This has been seen in Leonard Jones mixtures in the agent regime. Has been seen in soft spheres, has been seen in vortex glasses. The list could be long, huh? I mean, there are simulations of all sorts of systems which have glassy faces and where this violation of FDT with this structure has been observed. I can give you references and show you pictures.
What's the physical sort of intuitive explanation for what's happening there? Is there something you could, generalize?
Well, there are several things that can be said. One is that, this is very hand-waving, what you could say is that, okay, you started from a random initial condition, you know, some initial configuration which was typical of high temperatures. Now you quench your system and you look at the evolution of what's going on next.
Below
TC. In some sense, this is very hand-waving, is a remembrance, I mean, if the system is somehow remembering its configuration at an initial, its initial configuration which was at high temperature. It's not so simple as that, and there is a reason why you have this first, I mean, there is an explanation to why you have this first piece with the temperature of the external bath, and this other one which has to do with the structural configuration of the system. What do I mean by that? If you do experiments or simulations, and you look at the what it's doing each particle, this you can do it. But I mean, basically, you can identify or convince yourself that there is some cage motion that then takes place at short time. I mean, you know, for if you look at the configuration and then you let the system evolve for short time, you will see that more or less each particle is surrounded by other ones, it's in a cage, and then you can say, well, this dynamics, the particle didn't realize that it was in a disordered medium. It's just thermal motion due to the external bath with which it is in contact. So this is why here you have a result like an equilibrium. And also, if you go there, I mentioned that there is a stationary regime when the correlation moves from 1 to QEA, and there's also a stationary regime in the response. So for these short time differences, before this scale, each particle didn't realize that it was in a glass. It is like just doing thermal agitation, and everything is like in equilibrium. So this is why you have this first piece. Now, if you let your time go on and you let your correlations go below QEA, then the system realizes that actually it's not a liquid, it's a glass. There is aging, everything. The relaxation is much slower than in a liquid. You have to do big rearrangements to let your system relax, and so on and so forth. So this structural relaxation that happens later is the one that is remembering the fact that it's not in its ideal equilibrium configuration that should have at this external temperature. It's actually not equilibrated with this external temperature. So it's there that you see non-equilibrium effects like the agent and this other slope there. Something else I have to say is that if you notice here, this T star is larger than the external T. So this supports the hand-waving argument that somehow it's remembering a structure that it had at higher temperatures.
The phenomenon is it related to all the particles in the system, or only a few particles there are contributing to that effect?
Well, for the moment, most of the analysis have been done at the global level, so averaging over all the particles and not looking at fluctuations. But I can tell you more about fluctuations if you're interested. So you can try to do something like, you know, measure in regions and see how each region behaves with respect to other ones and look at fluctuations, but it's more delicate. I mean, we can talk about it later if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, no, certainly it's not happening all over at once. But, you know, this result here is the average over everything. So if at a certain time it's this one that is rearrangement, I'm picking this one. If then it's the other one, I'm picking the other one. On average, I get that. Then I can try to discuss what happens if I look at each one and where they fall on this curve. But, okay, we can talk about that. We have studied it, but it's a bit more delicate. Another thing I want to say about the value of this T star related to this hand-waving argument, too, is that it is of the order of TC. The TC where this happens and where you start seeing non-equilibrium effects. So again, it supports the idea that somehow, you know, it's where your system falls out of equilibrium. It's that conformation that you are representing here. But this is hand-waving. Non-hand-waving things one can say about this quantity as being a temperature. Sure, I'm sorry it's too late. So and the only thing I'm going to do is to mention them, and then if you're interested, we can discuss them more. Is that so? We worried about can we call this thing a temperature or not? And some of the requirements that one has to ask of a temperature is that it can be measured with a thermometer. Okay, so if I use some sort of thermometer that I couple to my system, can I go and measure this value, or can I measure this value? Because for that matter, you know, what is the temperature of the system? And can I really call this a timescale dependent temperature of my system? So the idea is that if you choose a thermometer, you have to choose a thermometer that is able to react to short time scales. So loosely speaking, let me put that T star here. So if I use a thermometer that is able to react to what the system is doing in short time scales, so typically what I mean is that there is some internal frequency, characteristic frequency of this thermometer, which is large, then my thermometer should measure this value. This thermometer should be able to measure what is going on in the system at short time scales, so it should measure T. This is what I expect. Now, if I put another thermometer that reacts to long time scales, time differences, I always have to talk in terms of time differences, like some low frequency thermometer, then I should measure the other value. Okay. So this can be proven. The fact that this exists, that one can choose a thermometer with these characteristics and go and measure this and this, we have proven within, again, solvable models. But after that, there have been, again, lots of simulations. And in particular, there are some simulations from Berthier and Barra, which are particularly nice, done on Lehner-Jones mixtures, where what they do is they put a tracer particle within the Lehner-Jones system, and they tune the value of the mass of this tracer. Actually, for technical reasons, it's easier to work with a sheared mixture. Doesn't matter so much. And what they have done is to measure the kinetic energy of this tracer particle in the transverse direction. So let me call it Z. And if one identifies the effective temperature, let me call it now TF, as the equipartition sort of argument, saying that the way in which this particle charges is measuring this effective temperature, what they find is that for low values of the mass of the tracer, they measure effectively, put values like this, the value of the external temperature, then there is a crossover region, which is quite long, actually. This is a logarithmic scale. And then the value goes to this T star, which is the same value that they observe if they do this parametric plot by computing integrated responses. And I'm putting an index k here that I'll explain in a second. So if they do for the same system the measurement of the integrated response against the correlation function, they find plots like this with 1 of minus over t minus 1 over t star.
And how do they map SI to the system
then? Sorry?
How do you map the mechanical system to the SI as the component? It's a really question.
Ah, no. Well, this is the first 20 minutes of talk that Jorge gave, in the sense that, of course, we are not doing the precise mapping of the one model into the other one. What I am saying is that these results have been derived first within the spin problems, that you could say they are so far away from particle systems. But the results that they predict apply to the particle systems. So
you're making the mass small or large in order to sample this low.
This is the mass of the tracer only. Yeah? Then the particles are, yeah. No, this trace is playing the role of this omega here. If you, yeah, this is what I said. Yeah. It's a suggestion. Well, the logical link would be do the mode coupling approximation to the Lehner-Jones problem. You'll derive equations that will look very much like the ones that we solved. And solve them, you'll find this result.
It was less elegant than the one of Barra and Berthier did, but we did, in compensation, we did check it with other things, and you see the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Javier, you wanted to say something, I think.
I have a feeling that most probably cannot explain that. That would mention that. That was an elastic system or an elastic system?
The
explanation by Barra.
No, it's elastic, I guess. Huh? It's elastic, yeah.
What's not surprising is frequency. If you said that you expected that there's going to be a violation of the fluctuation dissipation.
Right.
So the surprise is the linearity of this.
This is the first.
How does this simulation establish the linearity?
Oh, this is beautiful. It's really
two straight lines.
And then the other impressive thing is that if I put different wave numbers, I didn't explain what the K was here, but there are wave numbers. If you do different wave numbers, you see very nice parallel lines. So this is the other check that we proposed with Jorge and Luca Pelliti time ago. So let me say that this is with Jorge and Luca Pelliti. And finally, it's a paper which is reprinted in the 97 Santa Barbara meeting on granular. But it's up here, and then it's reprinted over there. So we were saying, okay, but if this is a temperature, it should be measurable with a thermometer. This is one check. Another thing that it should do is that if you have systems that evolve in the same time scale, you should have some sort of thermalization. So you should have that if you look, for instance, at observables, different observables, like the different KK and CK, do this parametric plot between these two define a TF or observe, measure a TF for each of these couples, the value that you get shouldn't be a function of K, because otherwise, you know, if you have one value of a TF for each observable, it's not nice. So this other check also, well, we did it within, again, solvable models, but it has also been done in a number of numerical simulations of different systems of particles in interactions and so on, which are more realistic. So, and it works. Something I want to say, just maybe the one warning, is that some people tend to work with this slope here. This is not correct. You see, if you go and look at what happens with this, and you don't take care of the separation of these two slopes that you get because of the separation of time scales, you won't get all these nice properties of a temperature. In particular, it's clear that, you know, each observable will give you a different slope. So this is just a warning. I don't know if there are more questions, but I
you introduced this concept of entropy.
Right, yes, so this is...
Much about that.
No, exactly. So now it comes. I think it's... For checks, there are other checks that can be done, have been done, so I won't go on with that. So this is, I kept this picture here for one reason, and this is the last thing I'll say, is that Edwards or other people thought about relating an entropy to this temperature, in the sense that, okay, can we have a sort of microcanonical definition of temperature? That's this effective temperature defined this way, with this nice, I insist, this separation of timescales taking into account, be related to something like V of sigma. Let me work at zero temperature, and then I'll tell you how it goes at finite temperature. So if I go, I compute the number of minima, for instance, that I get at, so absolute minima of the potential energy landscape that I get like this. And I look at those, at that number, at evaluated where. Okay, so what I want to do is to relate this relay, to make a relation between this and this value, V star. But I have to say where I should, you know, on this landscape, at which value of V I should evaluate this this complexity. So the thing is that if one goes and evaluates this complexity at the value of the energy density, which is reached dynamically. So what I mean by this is that in the same models, I compute the limit of time going to infinity of the energy density that depends on time. And I look at the value that is reached asymptotically in time, and I plug in this value here. I do this calculation. I find that this is identically equal to 1 over T star. Okay? And this argument can be extended to finite temperatures, external temperatures, if I do it with a free energy. Okay. So this is very nice, because it's relating, again, this value here now to some static property or landscape property of my Hamiltonian, of the original Hamiltonian. And again, this can be done exactly for this model, and the result holds. It has been done numerically, for instance, by Hernán, Maxe, and Jorge in the context of granular matter, computing the number of blocked configurations of a granular system, and taking this sort of calculation and comparing with the value of T star that is obtained from the simulation that uses the correlations and the responses and compares them in this way and you get with the numerical error, of course, a very convincing result that the values are not the same.
To
be, no?
Absolutely. But yes, let me say all these things. As far as the moment you step on real life, they are just what you see in the simulation. There's no proof of anything. It's just a suggestion from the new field which you extrapolate to real life and see what you get. Is it exactly true approximation? Or when is it true? We don't have any control. And it's hard.
Are you finished?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one last comment about what happens in the limit of zero temperature for these models. And this is again important concerning this remark here, is that what you observe at zero temperature, there is a response, and then something like this. So, well, the limit of this slope, when t goes to zero, goes to infinity, and then you have a finite value of the effective temperature within the models and certain simulations. And if you want to know more about relations between T effective and entropies and complexities in this way, I recommend you to talk to David and Javier, who have worked on this.
Well, I would like to make a comment.
Yeah.
Because you get almost all these you don't use an infinite table. You know that just with the one-dimensional icing model in global dynamics,
yeah.
You get almost everything.
Yeah.
But also in the simulation, I want to say that I think the same tables of time geometry and infinite.
No, I agree perfectly well. The only thing is that historically, if you wish, this violation was first seen in the field and the connection.
Why do you think you need three spin interactions? It's global dynamics.
Yeah, for continuous spins, you need three. Yeah, sure. Of course.
We just do a spin interaction.
Right. Only that if you have this other, it's a Sherrington Kilpatrick model, which is slightly more complicated. But just didn't want to. Yeah. No, that I agree, absolutely.
I think the three, if you look at the Langevin equation, you only get the bilinearity in the equation.
That's right. So otherwise, it's linear. Of course.
Why
yeah.
The problem is coming because with two extremes, you don't have more potent and every relative couple the same qualitative
features. Yeah, no, there's nothing special, but that I agree. It's just technically, you know, if you want to do continuous spins because they are easier to deal with, you need three.
Can I get more and more beautiful every time? I see it, but I'm really puzzled about where to extract some physics or answers to other questions. For example, the classic problem in glassy systems are these alpha relaxation times or calculating the viscosity or something like that. We know that the mode coupling theory gives us a wrong kind of answer.
Right.
Okay? Now, all of the stuff, and in fact, it tells me that alpha relaxation time diverges at the TC.
Of course. No, that's...
Now, all that what you're doing is below TC, so which relaxation times are you...
No, we, of course, quantitatively, everything that goes on around TC, mode coupling gets it wrong, because, as you said, the divergence is different, and so on.
This gives you exactly mode coupling above TC.
That's right. Yes. So this is as mean field approximation for the ferromagnetic problem. You know, all the critical phenomena, you get it wrong.
But
you can say that somehow.
Below.
Yeah.
And the question is, Hartmann, is there anything I can sort of extract? Because after all, I expect to get some sort of Vogel-Fulcher kind of behavior, or perhaps Cohen-Grest kind of behavior for these relaxation times as I go to lower and lower temperatures.
Yeah, but what we...
And all of the physics that you're describing sounds right for just exactly that kind of thing, all of these questions about...
The claim is a little bit like saying, okay, the fully connected easy model doesn't get the transition right, it doesn't get the exponents, but it gets the ferromagnetic phase and the paramagnetic phase and the fact that magnetization is charging zero and goes on as a function of temperature, that gets it right and so on. So certain properties of the systems, mean field gets them right. But of course, we are not claiming that it gets everything right. No, no, no way.
Let me ask a question in a slightly more constructive way. Because you've got some intriguing features in this low temperature state of the system. And of course, as you know, I especially like the effect of temperature idea and this, and many of these other questions you're describing in really nice ways. What that suggests is that there ought to be some tweak that I can make on your starting system that would say do better than than mode coupling at high temperature. You probably can't do things exactly anymore, but would move you in a more physical way to the lower temperature.
Absolutely.
Like, for example, the facilitated models that don't really have a transition, at least when you go below what seems to be a transition state, but in reality we're long enough in terms of not to be, it behaves very much like this. But evidently for different reasons, it has nothing to do with the new field or with mode coupling, and indeed it doesn't even have a transition. So there must be some sort of explanation for this phenomenon which happens here, but that may be a chance. It don't depend on us in this context, but there must be something else that happens.
You're capturing something that smells right.
Yeah.
but it's not quite there.
So sure, and okay.
So well, in general, I mean, mode coupling gives you a lot of things, and experimenters like it. they know themselves that it cannot be right, but it does do a certain number of things in a suggestive way.
The good thing about working with this, another good thing about working with these models that look so strange, is that, as opposed to doing the standard way of mode coupling, is that you have a Hamiltonian, so you can go and compute all this metastability, you know, you can also compute all the states, and so on. And so the connection between this TF and sigma, the complexity, could be done because one could compute the sigma, that's, you know, coming from the other side, you lost all the energy potential.
One more convincing remark is that the one thing that you're not going to get from this approach is that if it's true that what's going on are really localized phenomena, as mentioned earlier here, and as
would require another seminar, but these models have also inspired a theory for fluctuations that may be wrong or right. I'm not claiming it's wrong, it's right. But okay, suggestive. And that can be also be put to the test against simulations, and you know somehow it's doing what it's predicting what the simulations are doing. So you know, it's very suggestive. These models are very suggestive. So without being correct, of course, they are not completely correct. And but, you know, you were complaining about something. No. Okay.
How would you map the mechanical properties in this industry? In other words, how can we use the result from what I did?
But what I can tell you is what to measure within your, you know, you can define your preferred correlation function in your system, define its associated response function in your system, which is not going to be this, of course. It's going to be, you know, density-density correlation or whatever you find easy to measure. And then, you know, what we claim is that this, whatever is the AB observables you're going to put here, if you do the AB associated response,
okay,
then you will find something like this.
You think any intrinsic property with a particle.
That's right. Of a system, you plug it in, you correlate with this same or another one, property of the system later on. That would be, you know, property B is the one that you measure at T prime, property A is the one that you measure at A. At T, you do the correlation. Here, you have to be careful and do the response of the same A with respect to a perturbation applied on the same B that you use here. And then, well, if this framework applies, so you will find this sort of response.
Are there any precautions that should be scalars or can you do it for velocity?
Well, velocities is a bit more risky, I would say.
Yeah, sorry. This these results hold for a system that was at high temperature and then was quenched?
Right.
Or they're related to something that has been constantly driven?
You mean with external force, for instance?
Yeah, or
shear. This simulation has been done under shear because it was easier. In this way, they eliminated the weight in time dependence, but they kept a shear rate dependence. So the T prime dependence here is translated into a 1 over gamma, the shear strength that they are using, in a sense. So the dynamics becomes stationary, and this is easier technically. And then you get the same.
Was it a thermostatic
system? It was. This one was a thermostatic system, yes. Yeah. But the one that Jorge used with Hernán Maxe for the granular, it was just sheared. I don't think it was thermostatic. You better ask him the details.
It was an effective thermostat because of the dissipation.
This is true. Yes, there is dissipation, of course.
By shear and dissipating.
There is dissipating. Yeah.
Natural dissipation.
That's right. Yes. 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 Yes.
Kind of
yeah. These calculations, I insist, can be done also under shear. I mean, the models can be solved applying something that mimics shear. It can be solved applying fields that mimic tapping. The analytic part goes through. Yeah. There, yes. I erase it, but yeah.
In this case, you're applying something that is infinite in time.
Oh, this one here, you mean? No, the shear is not the field I'm using to, it's not the forcing that I'm using to measure the response.
Yeah,
on top of that, they do the shear just to stabilize the dynamics in a stationary regime that is controlled by the shear. Next, they apply forces.
Yes.
For instance, like this, random forces. You see, and they measure how the motion of the particles respond to the forces that they have applied.
This simulation can have the interaction on particles that provide these forces. They just impose on the action.
Yeah, they're external forcing. Yeah. You can do it, yeah. Well, you can do it experimentally, I guess. No? If you charge. Yeah, magnetic particles. Right. Yeah. The one technical point, which is maybe not so important, is that it's better to apply random forces than just forces pointing in one direction because you move all the system. It's a technical.
But if you apply it only to one particle, then.
Yeah, but then probably the fluctuations are going to be horrible, right? Okay.